And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast where we take weekly tour news related to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Breon, Senior Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com. Jonathan, in the same room today. Amazing, right?
Professor, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to all our listeners out there. Belated happy holidays to them. I hope everybody enjoyed a great holiday season.
Hopefully nobody got any of the gifts that we talked about on the last podcast.
I know, right? All of the bad golf gifts. Yeah. Did you get any?
Of course not. I got some good books, though. I'm looking forward to actually getting some free time maybe down the road.
You get any golf in over the holiday?
No.
Of course not.
A lot of time with family and just the usual stuff, but no golf.
Yeah, no walks in the woods then.
No. Maybe we went for some walks in the woods, but just not the kind for any golf balls. No golf courses close by enough for me to locate any.
Awesome, man. Awesome. So we're going to do things a little differently in this episode. This is episode number 24 for us. But what we're going to cover in this episode for all of our listeners are the clubs of the decade. These are the top three clubs in each category, drivers.
I'm so excited for this episode.
I know. It should be a lot of fun. So the best three drivers, best three fairway woods, best three hybrids, irons, wedges, and putters of the decade. So this should be fun to get into.
One thing I will say is we say best clubs. I think some of these, though, maybe weren't the quote-unquote best for some people, but I think they were the most compelling.
When we say best, there's all different ways we can define that superlative, right? So one would be top selling, one would be top performing, right. One would be most innovative. So these are just the three clubs to us, Jonathan and myself, that have really stood out over the last decade for one of those different criteria.
Maybe we've had a couple of them in the bag.
Yeah, that's right. I'd be curious to know how many of these we actually own or have owned.
I have too many of these.
Yeah, I bet. So... So without wasting much more time, let's get into it. We are talking about drivers here first. So when we're talking about the top three drivers of the 2010s, Jonathan, what do you got?
Well, let's kick it off with probably the one a lot of people remember, TaylorMade R11.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the big talking point, we talk about driver technology. You know, things have changed a lot in the last decade, but the thing that stuck out about this golf club was the crown.
Yep.
It was white. You know, and TaylorMade wasn't the first to have a white crown. Ian Poulter, actually, I don't know if you remember that Cobra Limited driver that he had, the Z.
That's right.
That was white on the top.
Killer Whale.
Yeah.
Remember John Daly? We're taking it way back with that thing.
I mean, we are. And that's the thing is this wasn't new, but TaylorMade did it in a way, and they marketed it in a way, where it really stuck. You know, we look at all of the big names that use that driver. You know, DJ Luke Donald used it when he was number one. It had a peak market share, I found, out of nearly 22%.
Pretty high.
In 2011. That's really high for a driver.
If you remember, they did have a gloss black version of that club as well.
They did.
That they launched.
Yep.
But it wasn't as well received as the regular, you know, white version.
I kind of feel like it's one of those things where... If it didn't take off right away, I'm not quite sure if we're talking about the white crown on this driver, but it was just so popular from the get-go and so many tour players embraced it that I think that was the main reason why it ends up on my list. You know, it was interesting. I did a little bit of research on it and found out that they started doing, TaylorMade started doing color testing back in 2006. And so, I mean, this is something that was a long time in the making for them, going back 5 years from when it was released. So
a little peek under the hood with this product. The crown and the graphics on the crown, that was actually something that they went to a sports optometrist, basically. I'm pretty sure it was an optometrist. And it was somebody that specializes in the optics of athletics. And they went through a lot of different iterations of designs, specifically on the graphics that were used there.
Right.
And the idea was to produce a driver that would help the golfer align the club better at the address position. And so what they found is that going to those specific graphics in the white crown helped a player line the driver up better when they put it down next to the ball.
Here's something else on this driver that I don't think a lot of people really remember. It's that red aluminum plate that was on the bottom of the sole.
Dial, yeah.
Yeah, depending on how you adjusted it, you could get face closed, face open, or square. So I read a story about Justin Rose. He wanted a driver with an open face angle but left bias.
Yep.
Well, with this, by adjusting that faceplate, you could do that. So, you know, there was something more beyond just the crown, but that's, again, the thing.
We haven't seen any other manufacturers use that methodology for opening and closing
the
face.
Which is really interesting that you bring that up, because typically when something hits, like I felt like that did,
right,
you usually see it pretty soon after, and we never did with that driver.
The one thing with that dial, you know, if you're a player that soles the club on the ground at the address position, then that dial was effective. But if you're somebody that does not sole the driver on the ground, if you're somebody that hovers it off the ground just slightly, yeah, before you take the club away, then that little dial was not as effective.
And maybe it defeats the purpose of...
And I'm sure, you know, obviously that dial, there's a lot of weight there, and where they position that weight, yep, you know, they'd had to compromise for that or compensate for that when it comes to... you know, when it comes to the different weight properties and inertial properties of the club. So
more recency bias, I would say, with this one, but Epic Flash from Callaway.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen a lot of changes in the last decade for driver technology, but we're talking about a golf club that was designed using artificial intelligence and,
yep,
a supercomputer.
That's next level for sure.
It is. And I think that's what makes this driver so special is I think that down the road, this technology might become more prevalent in the industry. But for them to be able to come up with, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of simulations for a driver face, and to go against all conventional wisdom of the thickness and you know, the way that we've designed driver faces in the past, and to kind of go thin in certain spots and,
yep,
thicker in others, you know, that this is groundbreaking tech. And it's, again, it's one of those where I feel like it could be a seismic shift within drivers going forward, because I think you and I both agree we've pretty much reached the limits with face thickness and
out of the center of the face.
Out of the center of the face.
Right.
So again, this is
now we're talking about not hitting it in the center,
exactly,
of the face, which actually is more pertinent to the everyday golfer than the
sure
tour player.
And this is what they were trying to do with that, with the flash face.
Yep.
So that's my second one. And the third one,
couple notes on flash,
yeah,
face.
Yeah, for sure.
So I remember spending some time with Alan Hocknell, who does all the R&D for Callaway, and Dave Neville and all the guys over there. And a couple things that they brought to my attention. First and foremost, the very first iteration of flash face, designed by a supercomputer. When the first prototype of that flash face came out, all of the guys in the room with the design team at Callaway all looked at each other, scratched their head, and all decided that they should freshen up their resumes. Because they thought that this AI-designed club face was going to be a total disaster. You know, they hadn't tested it yet. They're looking at this design, and it's extremely counterintuitive. Obviously, it works because the driver's been a great performer for us at TruSpec and across the industry at large. Second note on flash face, and this is really interesting. I asked them this question last year when I got to sit in the room with them. This is prior to launch, just like you and I have the privilege of going and spending time with all these different manufacturing teams, and we get to see these products well in advance. And I said to them, you know, could we evolve to a day where we have a specific face that is used for somebody that hits it high toe, and a specific face for somebody that hits it low heel, and a specific face for somebody that hits it low toe? And they all just kind of grinned and had a sparkle in their eye.
Doing it.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about, you know, about supercomputing, quantum computing, is that it can, you know, develop multiple iterations of a product in simultaneously way faster than you can do it through conventional methods. So it allows them to prototype things much faster. And they all kind of had a sparkle in their eye, and they said, well, we're not going to let you peek too far behind the curtain, but yeah, there's the potential that could exist. And they've kept it very close to the vest regarding Maverick, which is their new flash face product that's coming out this coming, you know, product launch. But I have a feeling, my intuition tells me that the face of Maverick Sub-Zero, Maverick, and Maverick Max, I have a feeling that all those faces may be different.
I mean,
so you would
have to think with the way that supercomputer runs, that as it continues to learn more.
And the Sub-Zero is a product that's more targeted towards your better player who's going to have a different strike pattern.
Low spin, low launch. Yeah.
But just where they hit it on the face,
oh, yeah, for sure,
is going to tend to be a little different than the higher handicap, which is what the Maverick Max is targeting. So starting to really dial in face construction and the way that they, you know, generate that AI flash face specific to the demographic of golfer that's going to be using that product, I think that makes a lot of sense.
And in my last one, it's, again, kind of goes to what we just discussed there with Epic Flash, more to do with the face technology. Cobra F8.
Yep.
You know, it's interesting. Cobra, for me, I feel like F8 was sort of a turning point for Cobra. You know, for a while there, me personally, the driver was just okay up until that point. And then all of a sudden, I remember hitting F8, and it was like, okay, what'd you do with that mediocre Cobra driver? I mean, it was really good. I mean, far and away better than the previous products.
Right.
And that's not a knock on Cobra. It's just, you know, I don't really feel like that was kind of what they were known for, was their driver technology. And a lot of that, to me, had to do with the CNC milling that they did to the driver face. You know, they removed the human element. I don't think a lot of people realize that the bulge and roll properties on those driver faces, that's done by hand. I know those guys are really good at what they do, but it removes a lot of the need for excess. So you're able to keep tighter tolerances. The faces are the same from one to the next.
Well, this is the reason why if you go into a tour department and you watch your favorite tour player stroll through the tour department looking at driver heads, they go to, you know, they know that they need a certain product at a certain loft. They go to a bin that has a bunch of 10.5 heads, and they start looking through head after head because, you know, on the little cellophane wrapper that covers the driver, they have a little sticker which says the actual loft, the actual face angle, the actual CT of that specific piece. And they kind of cherry pick that one head that has the specific loft and face angle that they like with a maximized CT. And the reason that they do that is because there are little minute differences, especially at the tour player level, from one club head to the next. And it's because they're doing a lot of that bulge and roll work by hand, as you said. So with the CNC milling process, it allows them to control that, and it allows them to remove some of the variables out of the equation so that they can repeat the same design over and over and over. So, you know, it's going to make for a more consistent product when you pick up another piece of the same product that's going to play the same way. And that's really important. Really important to professional players as well as the everyday player, that what you end up getting is what you were fit for. You know, that's something at TruSpec that is kind of the core principle of what we do. Making sure that we build things under the tightest tolerances and that we replicate what's hit in the fitting exactly to the T, or as close as can possibly be made. So we've all had that experience at a demo day. We hit a driver, we hit it well, then we order one.
Take the demo driver, seriously.
Yeah, if you can, take the demo driver,
I can't stress that enough. If you could just take the demo if you're hitting it well.
I don't know very many reps that'll let you do that, but if you can convince him to let
just
you take the...
Just slip him a couple 20s or something.
You're better off to take one with a Skymark on it that's the actual demo than get a freshie that doesn't have a Skymark on it that maybe is just a little different.
So, in any event. So, those are my three. What do you got?
All right. So, my top three drivers of 2010 to 2019. I'm going to go through all three here, and then you can kind of pick it apart once I go through them. We're going TaylorMade Burner Superfast 2.0 TP, which came out in 2011.
I'll never be able to pick that one apart.
We've got an interesting story about that at TruSpec, working with a tour player. We had Brant Snedeker come to see us many years ago at this point, 4 or 5 years back, looking for a new driver. And we spent all day hitting drivers, and we couldn't beat the one that he brought with him, which was a TaylorMade Burner Superfast 2.0 TP. It's just one of those drivers.
It's probably pretty hot, I'm going to have to say.
Yeah, it's one of those drivers, honestly, Jonathan. Here at TruSpec, when somebody walks in the door with one of these, and we ask them, how have you hit it? Have you been to demo days? Do you ever find anything that's better? Were you fit for this? If they were fit for it, they like it, and they can't find anything better at demo days, it usually means we're going to have a really hard time beating it.
And it's from 2011.
It's from 2011. It's just one of those designs. Really interesting thing about this driver, the first batch of these drivers, I think they were all supposed to be 2 or 3 degrees open on the face. The first batch came out, and I think they were 4 or 5 degrees open, but something that was way more open than what you would want, which is the reason I loved it, because I couldn't hit it left. But I'm not picking this driver just because I owned it and used it and gamed
but
it.
But I will say that's part of it, though. I mean, there are going to be clubs in this on these lists that just they hit for us.
Yeah. Next one is the TaylorMade M2, specifically the 2016 version.
See,
2017 version was good. It was a lot louder. But the 2016 version, it was like just one of these incredibly versatile drivers. It was super forgiving, easy to hit, accurate. Went a mile, they felt good, they sounded good. It was one of the drivers that literally it just checked all the boxes.
I know one tour player that still has that driver in the bag, Andrew Putnam.
That's right. So
he's playing pretty well.
Whenever you see a driver, you know, a tour player that has a legacy product in the bag, we'll call it, a product that's less or more than 2 years old, usually tells you that either A, they have a tremendous amount of confidence in that club, or B, it's a club that performance-wise is just it's tough to beat. So the next one here, and this is something that's a more recent iteration, comes from Ping, and that's the G400 LST. I mean, how many successful tournaments did that driver have?
I mean, you think about Patrick Reed. I mean, he wore that driver out.
Still
saw trouble trying to find a new one. I mean, that was the
Hovland,
thing.
Neiman used it. A couple of them have updated into the G410 for sure, but there are some guys that are still playing the G400.
Yeah, there are. I'd say majority of their guys are using the 410 head now. But you're right. That 400 was just so good, especially that LST for tour players and
right.
big swingers. But yeah, that was a really good product.
And you know, Ping in general is known as being a product line, especially in the drivers, that's more forgiving. You know, they tend to be more forgiving on off-center hits, as well as, you know, they tend to have very stable club heads, and they lend themselves well towards hitting a lot of fairways. With the LST product, you know, Ping changed around with some of the inertial properties of the head, so that it was a little bit hotter, a little bit lower spinning. And all Ping products are always going to be more on the forgiving end. I would say that for every product that they offer, with maybe a little bit of an exception on the Blueprint Iron. But even the Blueprint Iron is far more forgiving than you would expect it to be. But
pretty good numbers with Blueprint.
Yeah,
for being
such a small blade. Yeah. But you know, when we're talking about G400 LST, it's kind of that perfect combination of really forgiving, but you know, gives a lot of
which is almost you never find in those low
so.
Spin products. You're always giving up forgiveness.
And that brings us into fairway woods. So I'm going to lead off with fairway woods here and kind of get into my top three.
This is going to be a shorter one because I purposely tried to not overlap with you, but we both have two products on here.
There are two products that were really just so far and above what else was offered in those years. Number one would be TaylorMade RBZ Stage 1,
rocket
not
balls.
Stage 2. Yeah, Rocket Ball. So maybe one of the worst names. Well, I don't know. We still remember the name.
They came out with Rocket Balls year
with
Stage 2. That was really bad.
That was brutal. That ushered in a completely new marketing team over at TaylorMade.
Well, that was a changing of the guard with you know, TaylorMade, and then Callaway made a huge push right around Stage 2. So you're right. That was a big change.
So the RBZ Stage 1 fairway that came out in 2012. Couple notes on this. Number one, RBZ Stage 1. Do you know what the market share was on that fairway wood?
It's got to be over 20%.
20? Keep going.
40.
Keep going.
50.
Keep going. That fairway wood had 60% market share for the first 3 months it was out.
Well, hey, if you're getting 17 more yards, which was their marketing.
That was their slogan.
That was their marketing slogan. They had the 17 on the hats for the tour pros.
Yeah, I had
they
to wear one.
They guaranteed that you would gain 17 more yards over your current fairway, which, I mean, that's an absurd marketing scheme. And
it is, but it was based upon the data that they were able to capture out of their R&D sessions. So why was this three wood so revolutionary? Well, there is a company that was kind of doing this before TaylorMade jumped on board, and that's Tour Edge Exotics. They were the first company that was really making fairway woods that were maximized for, at the time, COR. COR is, you know, the efficiency of how fast the ball comes off the face compared to how fast the club's being swung. And so up to that point, all the club designers had really focused all their attention, their design energy, on designing drivers to maximize COR. And Tour Edge was designing three woods and fairway woods to maximize COR, and that's why everybody that picked up a Tour Edge fairway wood was like, oh my God, these things go so far.
Oh yeah.
Because they were the only ones that were really focusing on it.
They had a huge cult following.
They did, and they're still a great product.
Following.
I mean, yeah, they almost had a product that made it on this list, actually. I almost put the CBX product on this list because it's just that good a product. But so TaylorMade was the first, you know, mass production major OEM that said, wait a minute, if we start designing these three woods up to maximum COR, the average player could see a benefit out of this. And, you know, we saw a lot of tour players having to go dial back to four woods with this product because the three woods were just going too far.
Well, they're still doing that now. I've actually talked to some tour players, and Tiger mentioned this recently. A lot of the guys out on tour now, they hit it so far that they have to go to a five wood. Yeah, you see a lot more guys. I mean, Tiger uses a five wood because he's trying to hit certain shots with it.
Right.
But more guys are using it just because, again, like you mentioned, just hitting it too far.
So the other two fairway wood products here, Ping G25.
That was another one that I had on my list.
Yeah, so Jonathan and I doubled up on this. And by the way, we didn't consult going into it. We didn't have any conversations going into this episode about what we were going to put on the list. Not in depth anyways. And so the G25 fairway is just thin faced.
I wore the heck out of that driver.
Yeah, it's, how easy was it to hit?
Oh, I mean, and even for me, I don't think I was in the trees searching for golf balls that often with G25 off the tee.
So
I was just going to beat you to the punch on that one, Tim.
So G25, it was just an ultra forgiving, really easy to hit, easy to get up in the air, had a shallow face on it. So it performed well off the tee. It was versatile off the tee and off the fairway. Definitely a product that I say, you know, obviously good players used it and used it well, but it was a product that, you know, higher handicaps could use as well. You know, usually the fairway woods are the more difficult, you know, they're the more difficult clubs in the bag for higher handicaps to hit. But this G25 product was something that, you know, higher handicaps were able to hit and hit fairly well, especially compared to the other products that were available. So, and then that rounds out to our last fairway wood that
I'd like to talk about.
Yeah,
one more.
Oh, that's right. And that is Callaway XR16. So this Callaway XR16... You know, it was a very light club head. It didn't feature some of the movable weighting technologies and some of the bells and whistles you see in some of the products these days.
I can't believe you picked this one.
Well, I picked it only because of what we saw at TruSpec.
Okay, all right.
It killed it with us at TruSpec.
Really?
Killed it. Because it was in line with what we just discussed with the Ping G25, it's very easy to hit, very forgiving. It was something that was easy to hit up in the air. It was a little bit more draw biased, which is great for the everyday player that tends to suffer from pushes and slices and fades. But yeah, we had tremendous success with it at TruSpec Golf, and all of our fitters were very disappointed when it went away. So I had to put it on the list just because of what we saw out in the field as far as performance. It was a really great product. So we've already kind of discussed that two of the three that I picked, you also picked. So what was your third?
Yep, I actually had a Callaway product on there as well.
Okay.
But one that I was kind of wondering if you were going to pick, and that's X2 Hot.
Man, that thing was good.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at that forged cup face. It was so fast. I mean, I remember hitting it the first time when I was testing it out, and I just laughed. I mean, it was the original X Hot was good, but X2 Hot was just, it was almost like on a completely different level. And the one thing about this fairway that I don't think a lot of people remember, and I'm sure the real gear nerds do, is this is back when Callaway was really making two dedicated fairway products.
Yeah.
You've had the standard X2 Hot fairway, and then you had the 3-deep. And this is the club that Phil Mickelson used for a large portion of that 2013 season.
That's right.
Just off the tee, did not use a driver.
So this was basically Callaway's answer to the RBC.
It was.
So TaylorMade comes out with a high COR 3 wood, takes the game by storm, dominates market share. Callaway's going, oh crap, what are we going to do here?
It's always nice when you have Phil Mickelson attached to the 3-deep.
That's right. And if you remember, that was when he almost broke the scoring record out here, actually, right across the street where we record our podcast here in Scottsdale. It was about a mile away from TPC Scottsdale. Remember that week, he went low like 3 out of the 4 days. And interesting story there that we'll talk about off air about the 3-wood that he had in play that week. But bottom line is that was what caused Callaway to say, hey, we need to come up with a high COR 3-wood as well. They ended up putting together that X Hot and then the X2. And like you said, they had a dedicated tee off fairway wood, the 3-deep. Really great product.
You could actually hit it off the fairway. I mean,
yeah, you could. Just,
if you were a good player.
Yeah.
It was a little bit deeper faced than
most 3-woods. So deeper faced 3-woods are tougher to hit off the turf.
Oh, for sure.
You look at the Callaway Steelhead product a few years back, and that was a little deeper faced. That was a great product off the tee. Probably wouldn't have worked with some of the players that struggle to gain launch and lift with fairway woods. But that's a perfect segue into our hybrid list, because I had the X-Hot, the original X-Hot hybrid, on my hybrid list of top three. So getting into that list, I had X-Hot hybrids, which were coming out in 2012. I had Tour Exotics, the EXS9 product. You're probably not familiar with that as much. They didn't have a lefty version.
They don't have many lefty versions. I had to get a jab. Unless it's like a major OEM.
And then the Adams Idea Super Hybrid, the 9031,
Adams,
2013.
Adams.
So, yeah, I mean, Adams was kind of a leader. Remember Nick Kent as well?
I do.
Yeah, so Nick Kent and Adams were kind of the leaders throughout the 2000s when it came to hybrids.
Yep.
And when Adams was bought out by TaylorMade, TaylorMade absorbed some of those technologies. You know, the Adams brand, you know, it kind of, it diminished in the marketplace compared to what it was at one time. But they always had amazing hybrids. They had some really good drivers as well, if you remember the Speedline. And they also made some great irons. You know, Ernie Els gamed a set of irons that came from Adams, and he loved them for many years. But specifically for this...
Tom Watson. You're forgetting Tom Watson.
That's right. So the hybrid product specifically, it was a little flatter than most. It was a smaller profile. It didn't look like a fairway wood. It had more of an iron resemblance to it. It was a very... it was a much smaller profile than most hybrids. So that was a product that was just amazing in the hands of a more skilled player. You know, being that it was flatter, a little bit less stable than most hybrids. It was a great option for that skilled player that just struggled with a 3-iron and a 4-iron. So that was an amazing club when it came out for a lot of players. The Exotics EXS9, that was a product that we worked with once again at TruSpec. We sold so many of those products.
I'd be curious, and maybe, again, this maybe isn't something for on air, but what products hit over the years?
Yeah.
That were kind of outliers.
Yeah, you know, meaning ones that maybe didn't get some of the marketing love.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they didn't get a lot of the attention at the point of sale that they should have, but in the brand agnostic fitting environment,
right,
that's
exactly.
That's purely performance based. Which ones really excelled? That would be an interesting topic to get into in a future pod. You know, which are some of the products we've seen tremendous performance from? Maybe didn't get all the love that they should have.
Yeah.
So. But getting back into these hybrid products, the EXS9, it was so high launching, high spinning too. It was a wonderful option. It had a little bit of offset. And it was just an amazing option for specifically that senior golfer that tended to hit it low and to the right and without a lot of spin, really struggled with, you know, long irons. And even somebody that struggled with traditional hybrids, this EXS9 product line, it was just so good for the everyday golfer that needed to generate launch and hit it up higher in the air. And then the last would be, as we mentioned earlier, the X-Hot hybrids. It had a really unique sole design. It was very curved, had a very cambered leading edge going from heel to toe. And it was very versatile to be able to use out of multiple different lies. And then obviously had a little bit of offset in there too. A little bit of that offset is great for, you know, a lot of players that miss the ball to the right, which is the majority of most golfers. So, and I know for you, Jonathan, you didn't want to focus as much on hybrids.
You zig while I zag.
Yeah.
I had to go a different route with this one because I feel like we're leaving a club category off of this best of the decade, and that would be driving irons.
Yep.
So I decided to come up with three that I thought were worthy of this list. First one. It's got to be the Koepka club. That would be Nike's Vaporfly. Vaporfly Pro. You know, it's not really a driving iron, I have to say.
Still in the bag, right?
It's still in the bag. I know that he has a handful of backups. I mean, it's like he just took a bunch just in case. And this club is actually a game improvement club. But Koepka used it. Rory used it. Paul Casey used it as a driving iron. So it's one of those clubs that I feel like there were enough guys using it at the time for it to kind of be deemed a quote-unquote driving iron. The Sub 10 face, you fly beam with the reinforced chassis. You know, Nike, for as much as people knock their products and the fact that they're no longer in the industry, it's easy to kick you know, Nike's hard goods when they're not there to defend it. But they had some really good tech in that golf club in particular. I think, again, because Koepka uses it, it has a cult following. So that's one of them that I
would
say.
The products they made for tour players were excellent.
Yes.
And that's I think, where the disconnect was.
Remember
there.
The MM Proto irons?
The MM Protos.
No, I mean, if they would have just come out with
the
MM
VR
Proto,
Pros, you've got the wedges that they ended up doing towards the end of their life cycle.
But I go back to MM Proto just because it looked so clean when they brought that version out on tour. And I remember looking at it, and Rory had a long iron. And I thought, if they come out with this, this feels like they've finally done it. Because every time they'd come out with a product at retail, I would go, geez, it doesn't look like what I'm seeing out on tour.
Yeah.
That was the difference, is that what you saw out on tour in the pros bags was not the same, and they changed the badging and the materials. And yeah, anyway, another story for another day. Next product on the list, Srixon, U65, U85, most played driving iron, utility iron, whatever you want to call it, on the PGA Tour.
You have one in my bag. I absolutely love it.
It is impossible to miss.
It feels buttery soft.
Oh, gosh. Listen, if you struggle with long irons, this is a legitimate testing option. Yeah. I would say at least bring it out there. From the guys that I talked to on the Srixon Tour rep staff, they said the tour players were seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 degrees higher launch.
Yep.
And when you're talking about trying to hit really firm greens out on the PGA Tour, 2 to 3 degrees, that's huge. I mean, you're able to drop and stop. So that's certainly one that I would say is definitely worthy of this list. And the last one would be TaylorMade's UDI, the ultimate driving iron.
That was kind of one of the first ones, wasn't it?
It was. It was one of the first ones, Tim, that really blended with an iron set. You know, they really paid particular attention to the badging on the Tour Preferred line.
Yep.
And if you looked at it with the rest of that Tour Preferred setup, especially if you had the MC version, it was tough to tell the difference.
Yeah.
It had a really thin top line, playable in the sole, but it was not clunky at all. And I felt like from that point on, you saw a lot of other manufacturers try and copy that. It really trying to blend it with a set, not make it look as clunky as previous versions. Tiger used this one when he first came on. A lot of their other two pros, I remember Dustin Johnson driving a par 4 with the UDI.
Right.
So
those things were rocket ships.
They were rocket ships. I agree. And it was, again, one of those that I feel like it was started a trend. You now see so many guys on tour, especially the big swingers, using driving irons. And this one kind of started that trend.
Yeah, and when you're talking about utility irons, you know, somebody who may not be as confident as they want to be with a 3-iron or a 2-iron or a 4-iron, but they have way too much speed to use a 5-wood because they hit it too high.
That's me.
So
that's why I use one.
They hit it too high and spin a 5-wood too much, but a 3-iron is just not consistent enough and isn't as forgiving as it needs to be. That's that type of golfer. They're right in the wheelhouse for these utility irons. And, you know, this was a category that kind of emerged over the last 10 years. It didn't exist prior to this. You know, it was kind of like hybrids throughout the 1990s.
Right.
That was a category that didn't even exist prior to the 1990s. And then we saw hybrids come to the market. Now we've seen utility irons. And I think
it's
utility irons...
taken over a large percentage of usage out on tour.
Yeah, it sure is. And you know, we've gone into this many times. Which should you be using? A long iron, a utility iron, a hybrid, or a high-lofted fairway wood? But the nice thing here is that for a section of the bag, which is, you know, that 5-iron, 4-iron, 3-iron, we've got a lot of different options now for golfers to maximize their performance in a section of the bag that traditionally is very difficult to hit. So that's great to see that club designers are trying to reimagine what they're doing in that section of the bag to give golfers more options. I think the biggest issue that most golfers probably have is determining which is best for them, because there's so many options. Best advice I can give you there is go see a club fitter. Come see us at True Spec Golf. It's usually pretty easy to tell with players which they're the best profile for, whether it be utility irons, irons, fairway woods, or hybrids. So
if you're a crack fitter like Professor Briand over there.
And with that, let's get into irons.
All right.
So I got to hear your iron list.
Okay. The top three for me: Callaway Apex, the original Apex that came out. You know, this is really, I feel like, the beginning of the player distance category. And this was them combining their face cup technology that they were using in Callaway fairway woods at the time. And it wasn't a clunky iron. Even the original, you know, they came out with a pro version of Apex, but the original standard version still looked really good at address. You know, you could blend it with a pro set, you could play it as a full set. They were just hot as heck. And that was again, the player distance category really hadn't been established yet. That Apex really got other manufacturers thinking about coming out with irons like this. Adams XTD.
Mm.
This is not one that I'm pretty sure a lot of people really remember.
Didn't make my list.
I'm pretty sure it wouldn't make a lot of people's lists. But why am I talking about a club from a now defunct brand? You know, this XTD iron was using a lot of game-changing technology at the time that you now see a lot of from other manufacturers. It had a cut-through slot in the sole. It had a floating face.
Yep.
And this is a forged product, Tim. So we're not
a lot of tech in a forged product.
And I'll get to why that's important here in a second. So you got the floating face, you've got a forged head, you have tungsten toe weights that are optimizing the center of gravity. It's also going to help with your launch and your forgiveness. And again, you have all this packed into one iron. This is like the ultra premium category back at the time. This was $1,100. For a set of these, which was top end.
At the time, that was definitely top
end. And now $1,100, you're buying a really good set of irons for that price. That's not ultra premium at all. I mean, now we're talking $2,000 and up for that ultra premium category. But this iron had a lot of tech that, again, you now see that's very commonplace from other manufacturers. So, you know, it's Adams. It's interesting. Living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I had a chance to be close enough to the Adams guys to know them really well. Not only one of the brightest engineering groups in the industry at the time, every one of those guys, I think the worst handicap they had was a 3. They played all the time. They were so good. And I feel like just because that they were that good, they came up with a lot of really innovative ideas. Last one, hollow cavity irons. I know it's not one specific product, but if you look at how the iron design part has changed over oh my gosh. It's changed so much. I mean,
I would say that this decade, we've seen a proliferation of iron technology that we've never seen before in the game.
Oh, but I mean, that I would feel like maybe fairway woods.
Yeah.
You know, we go back to rocketballs.
I'd say even
there's
even,
a lot of room for growth. Let's put it that way.
That's what I would say is that I think that iron design really had kind of stagnated. I mean, when you look at significant, you know, iron concepts as far as design concepts, you had, you know, bore through hosels with Callaway. You had perimeter weighting with Ping. You didn't see tons of tech in irons until the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
And now we've got multi-material designs, inner cavity designs.
I mean, the faces now on a lot of these hollow cavity irons are as thin as a fairway wood.
Yeah.
I mean, they're ultra thin, but the material on the inside is strong and durable enough to where it's able to help retain a lot of that energy. Some of them are more for ball speed. Others are to help kind of tune the feel and the sound of the irons. You know, it's again, this is one of the things that's really changed is just they're able to fill that cavity now. And, you know, again, going back to the XTD, that was a floating face. And now they're able to find something to back it that really just, again, kind of accentuates that speed.
So my three irons, I'm going to go with Apex as well. I'm going to go with the latest iteration of the Apex, though. They've added a few more bells and whistles in there with cup face and with variable face thickness and things like that. Just
micro
to make the
spheres.
Yeah, they've done a few more things. But the general design concept of the original Apex is still pretty much intact.
Yep.
Here's the thing. If somebody came up to me and said, okay, Tim, you're going to start up a club fitting shop tomorrow and you're only allowed to carry one iron head.
It's Apex.
Which one would it be?
Apex.
It would be Apex. And the reason, because I have fit tour players into Apex, and I'm not talking about Apex Pro, I'm talking about the regular standard issue Apex.
Yep.
I have fit tour players into Apex. I have fit 18, 20 handicaps into Apex. Obviously, the sweet spot for this product is probably handicap range of, let's call it 6 to 15.
Yeah.
I think that's perfect. But you're talking about it's kind of checking all the boxes like we talked about earlier. It's ultra forgiving. It's very easy to hit. High launches. You know, it's just, it's such a great product from a ball speed characteristic standpoint.
It is the kitchen sink. It's Callaway's version of the kitchen sink. It looks good.
I mean, it doesn't look hideous or grotesque from the top, you know, at the address position. it, like I said, it checks all the boxes. It feels good. It's giving you great distance. So, like I said, it's definitely one of the hallmark products of the 2010 era. All right,
so we both love Apex.
So Apex is up there. Next one would be P790. This is kind of playing off of your inner cavity idea. Yep. Of all of the inner cavity designs that we have out right now, and we have quite a few now, 790 right now to me is probably the best. From a ball speed perspective, it's stupid fast. You know, when we look at other products that are lofted at the same, I think the standard loft of a P790 standard edition is 26.5 degrees on a 6-iron. That thing is flying faster off the face than products that are less lofted than that. So that's kind of always my barometer for, you know, ball speed. When you're looking at a 30-degree lofted product versus a 26-degree lofted product, it's not going to be the same. The 26-degree lofted product is always going to win out. But when you get a weaker lofted product producing faster ball speeds than a lower lofted product, that's something that stands out to me. And so 790, it looks good from the top. You know, it looks more traditional, even though there's a ton of tech in there.
That's why you see so many tour pros using the UDI version of
the 790.
Right. It's,
again,
like
it
you
looks good,
profile,
but it's...
looks good, but it does a lot.
But it's got so much tech in there. Listen, I mean, there was a reason why PXG wanted to pursue action against TaylorMade for the P790. If it was a really crappy product that didn't work, I bet you they probably wouldn't have pursued it. So bottom line is this P790 product has done amazing for us at TrueSpec. All of the testing that we conduct, both player testing and robotic testing, it always performs. You saw it in Korea, what a ball speed juggernaut that thing is. So, and then the last iron, this is more of a series of products from Strixon, specifically the 45 series product. So 945, 745, 545. They even had a 345. Now, 345 probably wouldn't lump in there, but 545, 745, definitely. I mean, I gamed a set of these. I was blown away by their performance. First and foremost, they're forged at a forging house out of Japan called Endo Manufacturing. Endo does some of the best forgings. I would put them up there, maybe a half notch below Mira as far as the quality of their forgings, but it's still super premium. I think that Mira probably produces the best forge products, and a half a step below them would probably be anything coming out of Endo. Endo Manufacturing makes a line of clubs called Epon. Epon sell for like $450 per club. That's just for the head too. That's not even including the shaft. Well, Strixon has access to the same forging house, and they're doing it for $125 per head. So you're getting that value that
such,
you get out of a major
deal.
OEM.
I mean, when you say it like that, it, people
yeah.
realize.
And it's amazing to me how many players I have fit into Strixon products over the last 4 or 5 years with TrueSpec, and they look at me with this air of skepticism about them, like, really? You're going to tell? I came in here, and you have 40 different iron products, and you're really going to recommend a
they're
Strixon to me?
They're the sleepiest sleeper. I always tell people.
You gamed them for a while, didn't you?
Oh, gosh. And that's the thing. They're,
they feel
they're so
good.
They're so good, but nobody ever talks about them, and it's such a disappointment.
Now, the sole design. So we talked about the material. We talked about the forging process. But the sole design, specifically on the 45 series. I like the 65 series they did a couple years back. I love the 85 series, which I had in play up until recently, you know, this year. But the VT sole they have specifically on the 45 series. You know, there are a few tour players that are on Strixon staff, and they didn't want to switch into the 65 series. They wanted to stay with the 45s.
I heard.
And the reason was because of the sole design. It got through the turf so easily. It felt so great on the face at impact. Just amazing set of irons. And definitely, to me, something that stood out throughout the last 10 years as far as iron design. So with that, let's get into some wedges. What are your top three wedges, Jonathan?
I'll rapid fire these because I think everybody knows them pretty well. Vokey SM6. You know, that was the visual progressive CG technology.
Yep.
And this is an important one because Voke is a huge traditionalist. And I remember talking to him about this. And, you know, it was something that he was on board with. But you know, it took a little bit of, you know, talking to him and making sure that he was comfortable with having that visual technology on the back. You know, was able to lower launch, more control. You know, being able to kind of change the CG location between the lofts. You know, that's something that nowadays is very common, but being able to see it, there's something about, you know, just golfers in general, when you can see the technology and it allows you to understand
what it's doing. It validates it a bit.
It does. It validates what the product's trying to do. TaylorMade Milled Grind is another one that's more recent, but this kind of goes back to like the CNC milling with the driver faces, allows the sole grind to be precise from one wedge to the next. And this is huge for a guy like Tiger Woods. We always bring him up because he's one of those guys, he's so persnickety when it comes to the grind on each one of his wedges. And being able to have that sole geometry and just to CNC mill it, he's able to know that when he picks out a wedge that it's going to be the same from one to the next. And not only can you find that milled grind technology on his wedges, but you can now find it on the P7TW irons that he uses. So again, it validates that technology. The other one would be the Mac Daddy 2 wedge. And this was kind of the return of the Mac.
Stole one off my list here.
Roger F. Cleveland, you know, this was a product for them. This came at a time when, again, Callaway was kind of starting to really pick up steam. And Mac Daddy 2 really gave them a product in the wedge category that a lot of people took notice of. Not only did they have Callaway staffers, but non-Callaway staffers. I remember Harris English won Mayakoba that year with Mac Daddy 2. It had that ultra-aggressive Mac Daddy groove from the original. And since that wedge, they've actually taken some of the original, more profiling of that MD2 and brought it along in more recent versions. So yeah, I would say Mac Daddy 2 has to be on that list.
I like the SM5. The reason I like the SM5, not the
6. Interesting that I picked the 6 and you picked the 5.
I like the 5 specifically because the 5 is where we really started to see them build out bounce and grind options. They always had a very full catalog, but I feel like on SM5, they really started to offer something for everybody.
That's a good point.
And that's so important when you're talking about wedge fitting and wedge design. You know, a lot of folks may not understand sole geometry and, you know, the way that clubs are designed on the bottom shaping of the club. But the way that wedge is designed on the bottom of the club is as important as any other place on the club itself, because that's what ultimately is going to allow you the versatility to use that wedge from multiple conditions, multiple different face angles, multiple different techniques. So I like the fact that SM5 started to offer this enormous catalog of all these different bounces and grinds to the players. The next one that I have on my list is a variation off of Mac Daddy 2, and that is specifically the PM grind, when we started to see the PM grind come out.
I saw this on the final list before we did this, and I'm like, I can't put the same one on there, but I'm glad you did, because if
you know, the Phil Mickelson grind, you know, first and foremost, if it's a collaborative between Phil and Roger Cleveland, it's probably good for me. It's probably going to be just fine for me. So, but specifically, we've seen a whole category of wedges emerge from this, the high toe wedge. We've seen it come out with, you know, TaylorMade. Ping has reintroduced a high toe wedge, you know, and they were kind of the originators of it. As we discussed with Roger, that was kind of why Phil kept going back to his Ping wedge, was for the high toe feature of that wedge. And the sole geometry, once again, the shaping from the heel to toe camber, the shaping from the leading edge to the trailing edge, all those different features. You know, we see Wilson has come out with a high toe option now. There are a lot of different wedge designers that are playing around with high toe options. So it's just, and what's the purpose of that elongated toe section? You know, as Roger shared with us on the pod, it was something that Phil liked because when he opened up the face of the club, he's actually striking the ball way up tall up on that toe section. And he needed more material up there. There wasn't enough mass up there to be able to hit it up on high on the toe.
The story of how that wedge came together.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Combining two pieces is just...
Yeah, Frankenstein.
I mean, again, when you're talking about what's gone on over Phil's career with clubs, the way that wedge was created, the way the Frankenwood was created. I did an oral history on that this year, actually, for the Masters, which was so much fun talking to the guys that designed that golf club. Again, anytime Roger and Phil are involved, yeah, fireworks are going to fly.
Yep. So I love the PM grind because it's an innovative idea that, you know, actually had some it had some legs, you know, well before this was something that Roger and Phil did together, you know, as I mentioned with the ping wedges. And we've seen that it's so effective, you know, to use around the greens. It's really transformed a lot of players' wedge games. I can say this. I actually put a PM grind in play this last week. Got out and played some golf, Jonathan.
You played some golf?
I played some golf this last week.
On an actual golf course?
I played 18 holes. And I played 18 holes.
Was this like any like testing or just actually for fun?
This was actually for fun. I played 18 holes with some guys from work and had a 58 degree.
I didn't even know that you had time to do that. That's
I don't normally. And so I didn't. You know, we were playing in the desert, so I couldn't find any balls in the woods. So I know you're very disappointed about that. But the bottom line here is I put that PM grind, that 58 degree, in play. I hit that thing 6 or 7 times throughout the round. I think the furthest I hit it away from the hole was 4 feet. It was like cheating. It was absolutely like cheating. I actually I posted a picture on Instagram here where I almost called my shot. I was setting up over the ball, and I was like, I think I'm going to hole this out from like 90 yards, and I lipped it out.
We got to post that video on the Fully Equipped.
Yeah, podcast. So I got to tell you, if you haven't tried one of these high toe wedges out there, you don't know what you're missing. It's literally around the green specifically, it's like cheating. So, and then the last wedge, I think the RTX series from Cleveland. Once again, this is a series of wedges. They had an original 588 RTX, and they came out with a 2.0, then a RTX 3, and now they're into an RTX 4. It was the first wedge that I noticed that the micro grooves, actually, I could tell a difference. Some of the other wedges that had come out that had little micro textures on the surface, I couldn't really tell where those micro grooves were actually effective. But I had the RTX, the original 588 RTX in play for a while, and I was like, wait a minute. I do absolutely notice that there's more friction on the face using these micro grooves. And, you know, when you started to get into the RTX 3 and RTX 4 generations, you started to add in a lot of different bounce options. But most importantly, they carried forward that VT sole from the Strixon irons into the Cleveland wedges. For folks that don't know, Cleveland and Strixon are sister companies, so to speak, all part of the same manufacturer. And so they're able to take some of the technologies and incorporate them into other brand designs. When you're talking about, you know, the VT sole from Strixon, they carried forward some of that idea into the RTX series of wedges. So once again, turf interaction is amazing. You know, it's funny because I kind of have a reputation, Jonathan, as being a putter guy, but I'm way more into wedges, actually. I love wedges. It's my favorite part of the game is wedging.
More than putters?
More than putters. So
why am I just now learning this?
Yeah, so the reason for the putting was because of my own angst and my own troubles with putting. Because I always sucked at putting. So that was why I took such a deep dive into learning about putters and putter fitting. But if you're talking about just pure enjoyment, I've always been a really good wedge player.
Wedges are your jam.
And okay. And when you're talking about wedge design and all that sort of stuff, I enjoy that part of the game more than anything else. Short game, wedge play, you know, pitching. So in any event, that would be my wedge list. And that leaves us with putters. So
speaking of putters, why don't you bat lead off on this?
All right, so putter guy. Here we go. You got to go with TaylorMade Itsy Bitsy Spider Tour 2014-15. That was the one that Jason Day ultimately gamed. And then we saw DJ put it in play, and then Rory used it for a while. We've seen, I believe, John Rahm has used it for a little bit. So you see a very, very prevalent usage out on the PGA Tour when you're talking about the spider. They've now branched off into a million different spider designs. But this was really the putter that put TaylorMade on the map with putters. I believe that TaylorMade was third or fourth with market share on putters up until the proliferation of this spider design. And after this spider design, you know, they're number two out on tour in putter usage now. And there are some weeks where they compete for the number one spot. But bottom line here is that we've seen this basic design principle I don't want to say copied. We'll say borrowed. We'll say borrowed from other manufacturers, especially
That's
lately.
That's a nice way to put it.
Especially lately. We've seen it borrowed by quite a few manufacturers lately, actually. So, and the idea here was to put a slant neck or a flow neck onto a high MOI mallet so that the mallet would have a ton of toe hang, but also have tons of forgiveness and high MOI. So that's what we saw out of the Spider, especially that little slant neck Spider. That would be putter number one. Putter number two for me would be the Toulon franchise. So before Toulon was bought out by Callaway, they were a freestanding putter company that specialized in handcrafted, you know, customized designs. And the thing that Toulon really brought to the table, and we saw some of this out of David Adel putters, was the concept of drop-in hosels and some of these customizations. And I'm not talking about customizations just with a different paint job or finish or stamping or something like that. I'm talking about intermixing different hosel designs with different head designs to let you achieve a customized putter that had specific offset and toe hang properties for a specific head shape. That was pretty innovative at the mass production level. You know, with the David Adel system, this was something that they did for years through their fitting system, but, you know, not a lot of golfers are very familiar with Adel putters. Toulon was the first group that started to do this at a mass production level, and obviously when they were acquired by Callaway, it just offers a golfer a lot of versatility as far as fitting options. And that leads me into my last putter of the decade. And we
you
mentioned
stole this one.
I did not steal it.
This was on my list. So, I'm serious. You stole this one.
This wasn't
a good one.
This wasn't a high selling putter. This wasn't a tremendous performer.
Maybe the most important putter.
It wasn't a innovative design, so to speak. But from an impact standpoint, this may have the most impact of every club that we've mentioned thus far. And the putter of mention is the Odyssey White Hot XG Sabertooth Long Putter from 2013.
The Keegan.
This is the putter that Keegan Bradley won the PGA Championship with. And this is the putter that really galvanized the movement against belly and long putters. And once we started to have tour players winning major championships,
Adam Scott,
with a long belly putter, all of a sudden, the rest of the tour said, wait a minute here. Should these things really be legal? And, soon after, what was it? Next year they were banned? 14?
That was when when everything went in place that next year. But let me ask you a question really fast. Do you really think, and I don't want to go too far off the rails here with this, but do you really think it made that much of a difference? I mean, if...
Yes.
So you think if belly putters were still around, do you think we would have seen more major winners using a longer belly?
So here's the thing. Belly putters, it was interesting. I was part of a group that did some research on belly putters. And when you're talking about putting, Jonathan, the skill that's ultimately being tested, and this is the skill that's being tested regardless of what club you're using, it's the ability to hit the ball in the center of the face with a square club face. And for putting specifically, a square club face is the part that's really, really important. So if you anchor the butt of the club up against something, you prevent the club from twisting. And that twisting action is ultimately what causes the club face not to be square. So if you're anchoring a putter, especially the butt end of the putter, up against another object, you're preventing the face from twisting, which means you're inherently causing the club face to do what? Be a lot more stable and not turn as much. So it undermines the entire concept of the skill being tested when you're talking about golf. So for me, yes. I think that belly putters definitely were something that, listen, for the everyday golfer, this is one of these things where for the average amateur, let them use a belly putter. Like, have at it. But when you get to the PGA Tour, guess what? I don't think you should be using belly putters. And the reason being that it's undermining one of the basic principles of what you're testing when you're playing the game as far as performance, which is squaring the face of the club.
It was 2016, by the way.
Was that when the ban went into place?
Because they gave them a little bit of a heads up.
Yeah, that's right. They gave them a 2-year moratorium over the long putter, and then they finally had to ditch him.
Okay, and we'll end it after this, and I'll go into my putters. But where do you fall on the Kuchar method?
So arm locking.
Yeah.
So number one, we can make an entire pot against
a ball. Oh, I know, and I think, like I said, don't go off the rails, but since we're talking about...
We'll keep this 90 seconds or less. Yeah. First and foremost, for all you listeners out there, do not, I repeat, do not try to take your current putter and turn it into an arm lock putter. You will destroy your putter. It will happen. It'll never be the same again. It's a really bad idea. The thing that a lot of folks don't understand is that the loft on a putter is predicated based upon the angle created between the face and the sole, not the face and the shaft. When you start playing with the loft of a putter, you start manipulating some of these properties, and that's why you'll end up ruining it. So, as far as the Kuchar method having merit, absolutely I think it has merit. I think an arm lock concept or an arm lock method is definitely something that can stabilize the putter, for sure. That being said, it's not for everybody. And have you ever tried to putt with arm lock?
I have. I can't get used to the feel. It's everything at impact.
That's my thing, too.
Yeah.
I can't get used to the feel either. Now, if you're somebody that can get used to the feel, and you can get used to speed control using an arm lock putter, and you find that it keeps your club face more stable, I'm all for it. But I think it has merit in it. It's for some people out there, but it's not like everybody's going to widely adopt arm lock putting and have success with it. So where are you at on your putters? I got to hear your list.
All right. Three, again, as rapid fire as I can go with these. TaylorMade, Spider, but the red version. Because that was a putter that, again, kind of going back to R11 with the white crown, it just popped. And, you know, Jason Day won the Players' Championship with the red version. That color was actually, and these are the stories that I love, because it's like I can never tell if it's real or not, or if it's just a marketing story. But there was a spider, a redback spider, that was supposed to be the color from that spider was used for the color on Day's mallet. And then it kind of proliferated. Those red putters were everywhere. And the funny story is about those putters is they had a black version that tour players wanted to use.
Yeah.
But because the red was so visible, TaylorMade actually was telling tour pros, hey, look, you want to use the putter? Cool. You got to use the red one.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You can't use the black one. And I know a lot of guys that wanted to. But again, because it was so popular and there were so many guys that were winning with the red version, guys just said, the heck with it. Like, I'll just use the red version if it's either that or nothing. It really had a big following for a while. I mean, it was the most popular putter on tour. So many guys were using that. Even blade players were giving that.
Because it had that toe hang, like I mentioned.
You're right.
And so I think that the spider putter actually is what started the industry down this super high MOI craze when you're talking putter design. It kind of was starting a little bit before that.
Yeah, it was, but I would agree.
But I think the spider is what really made it gain momentum. Yeah. And now that's, you know, every putter designer out there is talking about MOI and increasing MOI.
And don't forget Odyssey, right after Spider started to gain momentum, they came out with a red version for their putter. Color was pretty close, even though both claimed that they were different, it was really close. The next one, again, some recency bias here, but would be Axis One, the Rose Proto putter. And look, you know, Axis One has some really different technology. We've talked about toe hang versus toe up, and you know, this is one of those putters where, based on the center of gravity positioned, it's positioned on the center of the face, aligned with the axis of the shaft, and it keeps that face square at impact. So when you roll putts with this putter, the face does not rotate at all. It's just straight back, straight through. It's great for a putter who struggles with consistency. And look, Justin Rose is not a putter who struggles with consistency, but he even improved coming off a year when he was really strong with that Ardmore putter that we've talked about before. And something else with this Axis that I think is important is it legitimized a relative unknown. You know, Axis One had been out in the space for a little while, but it's really difficult to catch momentum and to catch the attention of a major tour pro without some sort of money behind it. And Justin, more than anything, was just intrigued by the design and the technology behind this putter. Last one on my list would be Odyssey Stroke Lab. Again, more recent, but The multi-material shaft, I would say, and I don't know where you fall on this, Tim, but I would say it's probably one of the biggest equipment stories this year on tour, the multi-material putter shafts. You know, we not only had Stroke Lab, Stability had one. I remember seeing KBS tinkering around with a different shaft design.
Yep.
LA Golf with Bryson. You know, there were a lot of multi-material putter shafts. And this one in particular, you know, the Stroke Lab as a whole, but I kind of go back to, again, to that shaft. You had Mickelson using the putter with the shaft, the multi-material shaft, Xander.
Yep.
A lot of their tour pros embraced this technology.
So one of the things that Callaway and Odyssey stated, you know, when they introduced Stroke Lab, was that it helped with stroke pacing. And so what is the Stroke Lab shaft? Well, let's back up one step further and talk about putter shafts in general. For years, a putter shaft was a putter shaft was a putter shaft. Like, there wasn't any real tech in a putter shaft, so to speak. Then we started to see some carbon fiber putter shafts come out. Then we started to see some variations on that. Then we get some, you know, interesting designs like Stability shaft. Now we see Stroke Lab. What is Stroke Lab doing specifically? This is a really interesting thing to discuss here, Jonathan, and that is, this is something that even gearheads may not be familiar with. Every club has kind of two MOIs. Did you know that?
Two MOIs?
So you have the MOI of the head.
Right.
And that's what the ball knows. So when you strike a ball off the center of the face, the MOI of the head is what keeps the head stable and prevents it from twisting and losing energy.
Shaft MOI.
Then you have the MOI of the entire assembly of the golf club. And that's with the shaft and grip installed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what's the overall moment of inertia of that club? What Stroke Lab is doing with their shaft is they're taking weight out of the center, they're taking mass out of the center of the shaft, and redistributing it to the tip section and the butt section.
It's 40 grams lighter than steel, the shaft.
And the reason that they're doing this is by redistributing that mass to the tip and to the butt section of the shaft instead of the middle, it increases the club's overall MOI. Now, what impact does the club MOI have over the way a putter plays? A high MOI head is going to prevent face twisting at the moment of impact and energy loss. A high MOI club is going to make that putter head swing back and swing through more stable and more uniform without as much twisting during the actual stroke motion. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So the other thing that they claimed was that it helped with stroke pacing. This is something that I just learned a couple weeks ago at the Flatstick Academy conference with my friend David Orr in North Carolina. We had 25 of some of the best putter instructors, and I was able to present on club fitting, specifically putter fitting.
You were geeking out.
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun. And we had a gentleman by the name of Biv Wadden, who's done a lot of research on this specifically, the concept of whole club MOI and specifically stroke pacing and the pace of the backstroke compared to the through stroke. And all of his research, now Biv's not on Odyssey staff, he's not getting paid by anybody to come up with these findings. Biv found that what Callaway states as far as stroke pacing is dead on the money, that this high MOI, Stroke Lab shaft helps with stroke pacing, which therefore has an effect over speed control. And so basically what he said is that this type of putter shaft with weight distributed towards the toe or towards the tip and the butt section is going to help you with the pace of your putting stroke. And the consistent pace on your putting stroke is going to help you deliver consistent pace as far as the pace of your putts. So if you're somebody that struggles with speed control, you hit one close to the hole, then you hit one 5 feet past and 5 feet short. And if the reason that you struggle with speed control is the pace of your putting stroke, this could be a perfect, a perfect remedy for you. So I would agree with you. It's definitely interesting to take a look at putter design and the way that, shaft design has really evolved over the last, specifically just 5 years, which then begs the question, that completes the top 10, or the top three, I should say, in each category for the 2010s. What do you think's on the horizon?
Oh, man. I still think that we have some growth in iron design.
Yeah.
I think that's where we're really going to start to see some of the manufacturers. You know, I go back to what Callaway is doing with supercomputers and wonder if others are going to start to dabble in that, but it's cost so much money. Yeah. You know, you have to invest a lot in that, and I think the manufacturers have to know that they're going to get some sort of ROI. Callaway clearly is, but, you know, they've had some really successful years where it's probably a little bit easier to go out and get a supercomputer. So, yeah, I think Iron Design putters, to me, too. You know, we've seen some really interesting designs here in the last couple of years, blades that have some mallet properties to them. I think, yeah, if I was going to put my money on two areas where we're going to see some pretty significant growth, I'd say irons and I would say putters. What about you?
So for me, I think just blanketly across all categories, off-center hits. I think this is where we're going to see a huge advance forward in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I would agree.
When, you know, not hitting the ball in the center of the face, not having the face square to the path or to the target, you know, these are conditions that are going to cause the ball to lose distance and fly offline. And this is where I think club designers are really starting to focus. Understand, and honestly, Jonathan, if they start really focusing on off-center hits and askew face angle positions at impact, that's going to help out the everyday golfer more than everything we've seen over the last 15 years with the proliferation of distance. I mean, we've seen the ball speeds go up out of the center of the face. We've seen, you know, all these different technologies to maximize distance and ball speed and carry when the ball's hit in the center. That's amazing for tour players. And I think that that's why you would say that, you know, the quality of play out on the PGA Tour has drastically improved over the last 10 to 15 years. It seems like every year somebody's shooting sub 60 now, and it used to go decades between 59s. So at the tour level, we've seen that all this design and tech has really helped these guys because they hit it out of the center, and that's where the tech is really focused. Now in the next 10 years, I think you're going to see designs coming out of brands that are more conducive towards the everyday player.
We've seen it with some of the brands that we've talked about on
just recently, in club tests this year.
Just in club tests, I mean, some of the numbers off of the center and the toe.
Yeah,
I mean, not that far off.
So one product had a 7-yard difference between hitting it on the toe and hitting it in the center. Another product had a 40-yard difference between hitting it in the toe and hitting it in the center.
Some are doing a better job than others. So let's just put it that way.
So that's where you're going to really see a differentiation between, you know, good designs and bad designs, and is that part of it. I would love to see a bifurcation of the rules sometime in the next 10 years.
Good luck, Tim.
I'd love to see good luck, man. I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
You think we'll see a standardized ball in the next 10 years?
I would love to see a standardized ball, or at least have some.
I know a couple brands that'll never let it happen.
Oh yeah, and that's where I go back to. That's never going to happen because there are some brands that have a lot of clout.
We've got too much clout in the industry.
I mean, but it would be fun to see what would happen if you had a tour ball that rolled it back a little bit. Just again, and I don't even know, but like have one tournament on the tour schedule just to test it out, kind of like they did for that year with the glowing puck in the NHL.
Yep.
Where, you know, to try and see if it'd make it easier to track. And it was a terrible idea. It was awful.
Or even if it's just one event.
That's just what I'm saying. Just one event. Just test it out. See what happens. See what the response is. But yeah, I would love to see it happen. But I don't see. But yeah, golf ball technology. That's an interesting one that I didn't really.
I think we're going to see some leaps forward there too.
Yeah, we didn't really even talk balls, but yeah, that's certainly one where we've started to see some leaps forward.
My top three golf balls of the decade, I would say. Bridgestone 330 RX for the slower speed players. Mm-hmm. I would say the TP5 series out of TaylorMade. It's, in my mind, it's one of the best performing products that's out there, bar none. And then obviously Pro V. I mean, Pro V is still kind of ubiquitous to the category. Those are my three best golf balls, I would think.
And that'll do it for our best clubs of the decade, better known as episode 24. We'll be back again next week with the regular format, where Tim and I will have a lot to discuss with the tour restarting in Hawaii. With gear news coming fast and furious in the coming weeks, be sure you keep it locked on our social accounts, particularly the new fully equipped handles. go ahead and follow them at Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram and at Fully _Equipped on Twitter. And if you want to follow our personal accounts, it's at Tim_Breon78 on Instagram and at Club Whisper on Twitter. And I'm at Jonathan R. Wall on both platforms. Happy New Year. Thanks for listening. See you around.